This summer, First Lady Michelle Obama highlighted a piece of American history that is not terribly well known.
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
The White House, literally, built by slaves. For generations, U.S. presidents had slaves. 10 of the first 15 presidents were either slave owners or they were raised in slave-holding households. This is a fact that's often left out of history books. You may know author Ken Davis from his Don't Know Much About History series. Davis chronicles the lesser-known history of the presidency and slavery in his book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. Ken joins us now from New York. Good morning, Ken Davis.
Good morning, Adam. It's a pleasure to be with you. I just want to start, before I say anything,
sure.
I was listening to Celeste's riveting interview with Cecily McMillan.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we talk about history, I think, is to connect the past to the present. And listening to her speak about Rikers and the justice system in America today, part certainly of the legacy of slavery is what we are talking about when we're talking about the criminal justice system today and separate and unequal law in this country. So always important to remember that the past isn't really past, as William Faulkner once said.
Well, I think we'll be sure to circle back to that. But for right now, let's start at the beginning of the story that you're telling in this new book. You focus on the narratives not of the slave-owning presidents, the very famous people, but on the narratives of the slaves themselves, the people owned by those presidents. That's obviously a very intentional choice on your part.
Completely. The fact is that for about 30 years, I've been writing about American history and was always fascinated by this question of the contradiction between men like Washington and Jefferson talking about liberty and equality, but then going back to plantations completely dependent upon enslaved labor. And I tried to answer that question in their words and actions for a long time and decided at this point, no, I have to really look at it from the other side. So I focused on the stories of five enslaved people, each of them owned in the technical sense by a president. Two of them belonged, again, legally belonged to George Washington, and the others were the property of Jefferson, Madison, and Andrew Jackson. Of course, we say this that slaves built the White House. Of course, Washington and his enslaved people preceded the White House. He brought enslaved people with him to New York City and then to Philadelphia, and that's an intriguing story.
Could you give us the short version of a story of any one of these particular enslaved people who you're talking about?
Well, there are such riveting stories. Let me start with the beginning. The first is about a young man named William Lee, or Billy Lee. And in his day, in the certainly the late 18th century and into the early part of the 19th century, he was perhaps the most famous African-American man in America. People knew him as Washington's loyal manservant. Billy Lee had been purchased as a part of an estate sale, essentially. Washington went to a neighbor's property. His entire estate was being sold off to pay debts. And Washington purchases with basically a letter of credit for boys, and two of them are named William Lee and Frank Lee. We don't know who their fathers were. Lee was the name of their owner. Perhaps he was their father. They were what were known as mulattoes, or light-skinned blacks, and so Washington brought those two back to be used as house servants. The other two boys were dark-skinned, and they were destined for the fields, because in that time in Virginia, a light-skinned servant was more prized. And it's, you know, this is all repulsive, deplorable, we might say, today to talk about and think about. But a light-skinned servant was prized as a house servant because literally they looked more white. They appeared more white. and visitors to the White to Mount Vernon later commented upon how many of the enslaved servants actually really looked white. They were given dressed in livery and made to appear like the servants of an aristocratic English gentleman at the time. Billy Lee was with Washington every day of his life for the rest of his life. And he was with him when they went out to hunt in the morning, when he surveyed the plantations. Billy Lee was with George Washington when he goes off to Boston, to Cambridge, to take over the army. Billy Lee is with George Washington when he has the great victory at Yorktown, securing America's freedom. Billy Lee is with Washington during Valley Forge and the crossing of the Delaware. Billy Lee is with Washington in Philadelphia when the Constitution is being written, and Washington presides over that. So he truly was a witness to American history that we almost only see through Washington's eyes. Billy Lee left no writings, no personal documentation, but there's a good deal about him in other documents because he was so closely connected to Washington. William Lee is also significant because he is the only person who is immediately emancipated upon Washington's death in his last will and testament.
I'm speaking with author Ken Davis. Ken has a new book out that explores the lives of some of the slaves who were enslaved by four early U.S. presidents. That's the story of Billy Lee. I imagine part of the reason that you're able to draw Billy so vividly in your book is because his life is well documented, because he spent so much time with Washington. How were you able to draw and illustrate the lives of those enslaved people who were out in the fields and whose lives were no doubt not as well documented?
Well, indeed, all of the five that I discuss in this book are really people who are very closely related. I don't mean by familial ties,
sure,
although that happened also. We can come back to that question. But they were in the president's households 24/7, as we like to say today. There's much less documentation, obviously, about the typical field hand. We know what they ate. We know how many blankets they were given each year and what their clothing was like, because Washington would give his enslaved farmhands a set of clothes each year and a blanket each year. Jefferson did the same thing at Monticello. So we know many of the details of that. But these five people we do have documentation about. In some cases, two in particular, we actually have their firsthand accounts of what life was like. Isaac Granger Jefferson, to be more precise, later told his story late in his life, after he had been emancipated, to a man who wrote the story down. And that record actually is one of the major sources for a great many historians to draw on Jefferson's life and his relationship in particular with enslaved people. Another gentleman I write about is a man named Paul Jennings, and he actually wrote what is considered the first memoir by any worker in the White House. He happened to be an enslaved worker. He was taken to Washington, D.C., and the White House when he was 10 years old by James and Dolly Madison. He had been born at Montpelier, Madison's home, and he spent the next 8 years with the Madisons in Washington, D.C., and it's Paul Jennings who is in the White House and sets the table on the day the British attack Washington, D.C., and burn the White House to the ground. And his account is one of the real eyewitness accounts of the burning of the White House in August of 1814. A very, very famous scene. But he describes actually setting the table and putting out the ale and the cider for the president and his cabinet for when they come back. But it's actually the British who sit down to that meal when they reach the White House. And so his account is actually also a major source for historians who have gone back to look at the day-to-day life of what being an enslaved person in Madison's life was like. Paul Jennings is actually in Madison's bedroom at the moment of his death, because he also served Madison for the rest of his life, eventually slowly gained his freedom. And it was during that period of emancipation that he was able to record what are known as the Reminiscences of a Colored Man in James Madison's White House.
We're speaking with author Ken Davis. His new book is In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. We're talking there about Paul Jennings, a man enslaved by President James Madison, worked at the White House. In 1865, Jennings published, as you mentioned, the only known account by a White House slave. His great-great-grandson, Hugh Allen, talked with NPR in 2009. The great-great-grandson says that based on Jennings' memoir, the relationship between slaves and masters was a lot more complicated than history tries to make it. Let's listen.
I think when you read it, you see that there is some respect and I think some love that he feels for his master. But I also am sure that being exposed to the thoughts of Mr. Madison, especially with his role in developing the Constitution, a lot of those ideas rubbed off and I think caused Paul to be the sort of person that he became.
Now, after he was freed, Jennings visited former First Lady Dolly Madison, who was impoverished at the time. He occasionally gave her small sums of money. Speaking with CBS News, Allen says that White House slaves should be remembered for more than just being held captive.
It also creates a place in history for how slaves were a part of the history of the United States, not an index, you know, or a footnote that's at the back of the book.
Ken Davis, I imagine that you take Hugh Allen's point there, but is there a danger in emphasizing or talking about what could be glibly referred to as the positive aspects of an enslaved person's experience in the White House?
Well, I think that you have to take Jennings or Isaac Granger's references to Jefferson with a very large grain of salt. Granger writes in the 1840s or tells his story in the 1840s. Jennings in 1865, of course, after the Civil War. But one must still remember they were talking about the most admired, beloved right. heroes in American history. And probably we have to kind of footnote or bracket everything they say with the notion that it would have been foolish, if not dangerous, to speak ill of these people. And it also does get to this very complex relationship that these presidents, if you ask them about these people, would describe them, in many cases they did, as part of my family. And I don't mean to say that in the sense of, you know, gone with the wind, one big happy paternalistic situation, but they did refer to them as my people, my family in some cases, in the sense of an extended family. And it does get at this very, very complicated, tricky interpersonal relationship between slave and master, and certainly between enslaved person of some privilege to live in or near the big house was certainly a lot better off than living off in one of the field hovels, and that's the only way to describe them. And so it's, you know, we always have to take this with a little, you know, these firsthand accounts with a little bit of caution, but they still understood, and certainly Jennings understood, what Madison was talking about. He stood there at Montpelier while the great men of the time, including Thomas Jefferson, who would often come and visit Madison at Montpelier, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was an outspoken opponent of slavery, other men were in Montpelier debating the future of slavery. Paul Jennings has to be standing there, perhaps serving dinner, listening to this and wondering about his place in it. And indeed, he fights very hard late in his life to win his own emancipation, which he ultimately does.
We spoke to Emory University professor Thee Smith about your work. Thee is with the social justice group Southern Truth and Reconciliation. He says that while more stories about slave narratives are really welcome, he's not terribly optimistic that they're going to have the intended effect of erasing stereotypes. Let's listen.
for many of us, this is a kind of unending effort that always falls short of its potential impact of educating the public sufficiently to end common stereotypes. And I do try to be optimistic. I believe the Dalai Lama, when he says something like, if we could teach every 8-year-old how to meditate, we would have world peace in one generation. But I do think it requires constant effort, and I applaud Ken Davis for this effort.
Ken Davis, in the last 60 seconds that we have here, I'd like to get your response to that. I mean, your book is targeted at a younger audience for precisely this reason, right?
It is. I think that we have to, you know, really make sure that we clear the schools and the textbooks of the worst misconceptions and myths we live with. But I think we're at a real extraordinary moment with the museum opening up, as you know, on the Mall, a museum of African American history, Mrs. Obama's speech, Colin Kaepernick's protests about a racist national anthem, Black Lives Matter. Discussion of race is overwhelming in this presidential campaign. I think we are coming to a different kind of reckoning. Certainly the removal of the Confederate symbols from whether it's the flag coming down or stained glass coming out or Georgetown's attempts to reconcile with the descendants of enslaved people who are sold off to keep the college afloat. We are at a moment, I think, of very, very real reckoning, if not reconciliation.
That's author Ken Davis. His new book chronicles some of the slaves who served 4 early presidents. It's called In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, 4 Presidents and 5 Black Lives. Ken, really appreciate it. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.